Welcome back, everybody. Having studied the algebraic definition of tangent spaces, let us now study the physicist's definition of what a tangent space is, and then also the geometric definition. For that, we start by remembering that what a chart does. So we have here a manifold and a chart, an invertible differentiable map. We map the manifold, or at least a chunk of it, into Rn. And that means that the points of the manifold acquire through the map of the chart coordinates. They can now be labeled by the vectors in Rn that they are mapped into. And then we discussed that this induces, a chart induces a map also between the set of function germs over the point Q to the set of function germs, the algebra of function germs over the point P. And how do we do that? Well, a function that lives here, a function that lives on here, on top of that, so maps this as in, takes these points as inputs, can be prepended this map. Now our function takes as input points over there. And this means it has now become a function in here. It is an element of this space of function germs, because it takes as input element of this set. Now that we have a map from this algebra of function germs to that algebra of function germs, this also induces for us, in very much the same way, a map between these tangent spaces, the tangent space over the space of function germs over P to this space over there. Very similarly, a tangent vector is a map over these, because a tangent map, tangent vector takes as input an element from here, a function germ, and spits out the directional derivative. So if we take one of the elements here, it's a function over the space of function germs, it takes these guys as input, but we can prepend to our function this map here. So now our function takes no longer these elements as input, but because we prepended this, it takes elements from here as input. And that means that we are no longer dealing with a directional derivative which takes as input stuff from here, but from there, which makes it a directional derivative in here, because these guys take input from that set. And you see, in principle, it goes on like this. We can also go one step further and look at maps over these guys, and then that would induce, then this map induces a map over down here in this direction. You will actually see that this is happening. These tangent spaces are vector spaces, they have duals, and these dual vector spaces will also have an induced map, and it will go in the other direction. But why we did this, ultimately, was that we wanted to have a way to label not just the points of the abstract manifolds explicitly as n-tuples coordinates in Rn. No, we also wanted to have a way to label the tangent vectors, the abstract tangent vectors to an abstract point in an abstract manifold in concrete ways. And for that purpose, we use this map. Because this map allows us to take any arbitrary tangent vector to an arbitrary point of the manifold and then look at its image here, which is a tangent vector to a point in Rn. And we know something very important about tangent vectors to points in Rn. We know that they take a particular form. They are linear combinations of the partial derivatives, according to the algebraic definition of tangent spaces. And those linear combinations of partial derivatives are completely determined by just saying what linear combination they are. What are the coefficients of the linear combination of partial derivatives. And that means that we have a concrete way to name our tangent vectors to an abstract point once we have a chart. The chart gives us not only a way to label the point of the manifold efficiently, but also it gives us a way to label the tangent vectors efficiently by labeling through their images in the tangent spaces to points in Rn. Now, a bit of terminology. Phi star is called the pullback of the map phi because it's pulling back using the map phi. And then this map is the pullback of that map. Okay, so this is what I already said in words, namely that every point in the manifold has an image in Rn. It has what we call coordinates. We also have a map that maps the function germs into function germs, but in the direction of function germs on Rn to function germs on the abstract manifold. And finally, and that is what was our goal, we have that every tangent vector to a point in the abstract manifold has now a concrete image in a tangent vector to a point in Rn, to the point Q in Rn. And we know that tangent vectors, we did a little bit of a tedious calculation to show that this is true. Every tangent vector to a point in Rn is a linear combination of partial derivatives with linear combination coefficients. And these coefficients determine exactly which tangent vector it is. And using this one-to-one correspondence between the abstract tangent vectors on the manifold and the concrete tangent vectors, concrete in this sense, on a point in Rn, we can now label our points in the tangent spaces in exactly the same way that previously we labeled the points of the manifold, also using the chart. So a chart provides us with both a concrete naming of points of the manifold and concrete naming of tangent vectors of the manifold. Now, this question will lead us to the definition of tangent spaces in the physicist's sense, in the sense that Einstein would have done it. The question is, given an abstract point in the abstract manifold, P and M, and a tangent vector to that point, how do their coordinates and coefficients, so the coordinates is the map of the point in Rn, and the coefficients of, by coefficients, I mean the coefficients of the tangent vector when you map it into a tangent space in Rn, how do they change under a change of charts? So we are still working at this stage with the algebraic definition of tangent space. And this picture is similar to the picture I showed before, but now we have two charts. So I'm drawing a picture like before from the manifold into Rn, and the chart, let's call it beta, it's a coordinate system, beta. So it's an invertible differentiable map from the manifold into Rn, or at least some chunk of it. And we consider a second chart. So let's say we have another differentiable invertible map from the manifold into Rn, another chart alpha. So the same point has now two coordinates. It has a set of coordinates with respect to the first chart, and it has a set of coordinates with respect to the second coordinate system. Since both charts are invertible diffeomorphisms, we can concatenate them. For example, we can take this point Q, map it with the inverse of alpha into P, and then with beta into S. So overall, we get a big map, which maps directly from this coordinate system to that one. It maps directly from Rn into Rn, and that map is this one, which we may call phi. So phi is the concatenation of alpha inverse and beta, and this little circle means concatenation or combination. So it means first do this map and then do that map. And phi is a map from Rn into Rn, the kind of thing that we can do very concretely. Maps from Rn to Rn are easy. Now, the picture expands, of course, downwards with these pullbacks. So that's the picture we just discussed. But let's now look at the function germs over the point S. And the function germs over P and Q, these are these algebras of function germs here. And as before, the pullback of this map is a map which goes this direction. And the pullback of that map is a map that goes that direction. And the pullback of that big map is a map that goes in the other direction, down here. This one. Oh, wait, where is it? There it is, this one. Okay. Well, and then we have the maps over the function germs, namely the tangent spaces. So again, the arrows reverse, and we get these maps, as you might expect. Importantly, we get now a tangent map that goes from this tangent space to that tangent space, so from Rn into Rn again. And that map is important, because this is the map that describes how coordinates change. The same point, P, has the coordinates Q according to the one chart and coordinates S according to the other chart. And if we change, then the coordinates over there map in this way, and the tangent vectors map in that way. So we can now ask, how do the coefficients that label an abstract tangent vector, namely the coefficients eta I, get mapped into the coefficients that label the same tangent vector in our abstract manifold in another coordinate system? So how do these tangent vectors get, how do the coefficients get mapped into each other? So there are these coefficients nu I now that that label the tangent vector relative to this chart. So I already said these things. Well, let's go through it quickly. So every point P in the every abstract point in the manifold has two images, Q with these coordinates x1 to xn, and S, let's say it has coordinates x tilde 1 to x tilde n. And remember, the map that takes us from one coordinate system to the other, we call it capital Phi. It's a map that takes as input coordinates x and outputs the coordinates x tilde. So this was this map here. Coordinates x are mapped into coordinates x tilde over here. Phi is this combination of the two chart maps. Okay, so if we write it out without a picture, then this is what it is. These coordinates are given by that. And this is a very concrete thing. This is a map, it's a function from Rn into Rn. And as such, we can write it also very concretely. Each coordinate here, each coordinate x tilde I, is an explicit function phi I of all the variables in here. So we need to specify n functions, if the manifold is n-dimensional, to specify such a change of coordinates map. Then every function germ f in the function space above P, where P is the point in the abstract manifold, has two pre-images, originates from two images, from two regions, the pre-images. One is a function germ over the point Q according to the left coordinate system, and another is a function germ with respect to the point in the space of in the algebra of function germs around the point S. And they are related because of the pullback. They are related in such a way that they do the same thing. So if you evaluate a function G or a function germ generated by function g at the point q in the left coordinate system, you get a number, because that's what these functions do. These are scalar functions on the manifold. You get a number. It's the same number you get when you evaluate the function germ h, which is the image under the other coordinate system, at the point s, which is the image under that coordinate system. And it's the same as what happens in the abstract manifold. Right? So what I'm saying is, it's kind of a triviality, but you have to keep that in mind, that the point of these pullback maps is that whether you apply, whether you evaluate a function at a point here, or you evaluate its image under the image of the point, get the same output. Right? So you use a function, some function, and let's say it evaluates at the point p here to the value 5, then the image of the function evaluated at the image of the point p is also evaluating to 5, and over here the same thing. And the same will be true with tangent vectors. If you apply a tangent vector, directional derivative, let's say here in the abstract, you evaluate an abstract directional derivative onto a function germ, you get a number. The value of the directional derivative of the function germ in the particular direction that is indicated by xi, by that tangent vector. You get the exact same number as if you took the image of that tangent vector in one of those charts, any chart, and applied to the image of the function germ at the point, which is the image of the abstract point. And it doesn't matter which coordinate system you choose. So, that's what we write here. Here you're evaluating the abstract function at the abstract point, get the same value as if you evaluate one image of the function on the corresponding image of the point, or another image of the function under another image of that point. This is one coordinate system, that's another coordinate system, that's the abstract algebra, the abstract differentiable manifold and algebra of functions on it, and so on. And so in particular, if we spell out that this is equal to that concretely, it means this equation here. So this is the evaluation of a function germ at the concrete point. And in the right-hand coordinate system, this means the evaluation of that function on these concrete points, the concrete coordinates, is equal to what we get when we take the other image of the function evaluated at this other concrete point on Rn. You see, the point of the charts is, of course, that we can now do calculations because they happen within Rn. And similarly, every tangent vector, xi over an abstract point of the manifold, now has two images because we chose two coordinate systems, namely, xi is the abstract vector in the manifold, but there is an image of it, eta, with respect to the image of the point according to one within one coordinate system, and it also has another image, eta, on the other in the other coordinate system in the tangent space of it. And by construction, because of the pre-compositions, because this is a pullback, we have, again, that it doesn't matter whether you take the abstract tangent vector on the abstract manifold, have it act on an abstract function germ, it evaluates to some number. So the directional derivative of some abstract function on the abstract manifold evaluates to some number, and it's going to be the same number as what you get when you take the image of the tangent vector applied to the image of a function germ with respect to one chart, or in another chart, it looks like this. Same value. If we spell all of this out, it's this. On the left-hand side, we have the coordinate system x1 to xn. And every tangent vector on Rn, we proved tediously in the previous lecture, has this form. Every tangent vector defined algebraically as a linear map that obeys a product rule, a Leibniz rule, has this form. Every eater takes this form. And the G is a function germ, or a function germ generated by a function G, which can be written as G of x1 to xn, because we're dealing with a coordinate system whose coordinates we labeled x. Therefore, this expression must take that form. That's eta of G. Now, we cannot write down something like that for here. We don't have partial derivatives living on that. So again, that every directional derivative in Rn takes this form. This tangent vector takes this form. Then the second coordinate system is called, that evaluates. And we also know that when we evaluate a function system, or in the abstract case of the abstract manifold, that's a little bit further up, here. Or the image of F, the image H of F in one coordinate. So in particular, this is equal to that, evaluating. We can use that H evaluated X tilde is the same as G evaluates. Sorry, this thing is always in the way. X tilde variable. But suddenly we have X variables. You've of course seen all of this before in the untilded to the tilded coordinate system, the coefficients of the functions, and that means that the left-hand side has to be equal, but it's got to be true for all functions g. So these have to be equal. So this operator has to be equal to that operator, but we find the partial derivative in the third direction from the partial derivatives. So therefore, the eta I has to be equal to this. Changing the coefficients of tangent vectors as we change, which is of course obtained by just switching around where we put the coordinate systems, given a coefficient in that coordinate system, those coefficients in that coordinate system, phi I. Remember the phi, that's the derivative. Used as the starting point. It is so characteristic that which under change of chart transforms in this way, in superscript physics, in the tangent space of a chart, back to a chart alpha, and nu is coefficient in this way, with the definitions as we had two. We have two equivalent definitions of tangent spaces. We showed that the algebraic definition leads to the definitions are still, though, fundamental derivative. So the idea behind all of this is that fractional derivatives can be recognized by their property that they obey the Leibniz rule. Very abstractly, you don't need to have coordinate systems for that definition. If you want to actually get hold of those, give them labels, names, so that you can calculate. If you have charts, we can ask, how do the coefficients change under change? Now, the geometric definition. You have to do something with actual tangent. You know how to get hold of individual. Consider through the point P. So still we are interested in just one point of the manifold. Later today we will move on to the entire manifold as a whole. But still, we are doing these studies locally, which is why we're dealing with function germs rather than entire functions and so on. So we pick out a point P again, and we are interested in defining the tangent space to the point P. And for that purpose, we consider now all the paths in the manifold which happen to go through the point P. We want them to be smooth paths, of course. And how do we describe a path? Well, a path is a map from the real numbers into the manifold, because the path will have a parameter that parameterizes how far along the path you are. And without restricting generality, we can assume that the parameter of the path takes the value 0 when the path passes through the point P. After all, any path can be reparameterized. So we're looking at all those paths that pass through the point P when their internal value takes the value, internal parameter takes the value 0. So for any function now that lives on the manifold, let's say the temperature map. Let's say this manifold describes something on which there is a temperature. And F could be a temperature map. It maps every point on the manifold into a real number, which could be the temperature. Then we can combine these things, and we can say, I'm going to travel this path. What kind of temperatures am I going to experience as I travel along that path? So as the path parameter increases, which could be the time, for example, the temperature will change. And this is the function that does it. Gamma is the path. It's a map from R into the manifold. For every point in time, for example, I get a point in the manifold. I concatenate that with my temperature map F. So this, in total, is a map from the parameter, like time, of the path into another parameter, which is like the temperature on the manifold. So I'm simply having here a map from R into R, as simple as it gets. Now, two different paths can do the same thing as they pass through the point P. For example, one path may go through the point, here's the point P. So the path comes along, goes through the point P, and goes on. Another path may first do a few loopings, and then it goes to the point P and goes on. But it passes through the point P in exactly the same way. For our purposes, the two paths should be put into the same basket. They should be put into the same equivalence class of paths. Because what they do away from the point P doesn't really matter. So we define that two differentiable paths, gamma A and gamma B, are called equivalent if, for all temperature functions F, don't have to be temperature, but just to have some intuition for it, for all temperature functions F, and really function germs, because ultimately we only care about the point P here, for all temperature functions F, the rate of change at the point P is the same. Right? So we say that two paths are equivalent if they give you the same rate of change of the temperature at the point P, no matter what the temperature function is. Right? So if the temperature function, for example, was to be constant temperature everywhere on the manifold, well, then all paths give you the same temperature gradient as you go through the point P. But no, this definition requires that the temperature change, the rate of temperature change, is the same for the two paths, no matter what the temperature function is. It's got to be true for all temperature functions. Right? So two paths are equivalent, and you can intuitively think of two paths which are simply having the same velocity as they go through the point P. So the same velocity vector as they go to the point P. Such two paths, no matter what they do before or after, but if they have the same velocity vector as they go through the point P, will obey that condition. Because no matter what the temperature distribution is on the manifold, the rate of change of the temperature will be recorded as the same as you go through the point P. The only trouble with what I just said is that I said that two paths that have the same velocity vector at the point P. Well, in Rn, you can do this, say the velocity vector. But here, we assume we don't know what tangent vectors are. We don't know what velocity vectors are. We want to define that from scratch. So we don't have that available. And therefore, to capture that idea, we just say that two differentiable paths are called equivalent if, for all F that might describe temperature distributions, we have that the rate of change of that temperature is the same as if you pass through P along the one path, gamma A, or along the other path, gamma B. So the intuition is that the two paths are equivalent if they have the same velocity at P, except we didn't define what velocity means. (Clears throat) And then the geometric definition of the tangent space is that TP of n geometric is the set of equivalence classes of differentiable paths through P. Right? So if you take two paths that are not equivalent according to this definition, it means that if you travel one path or the other, well, there will be a temperature distribution such that you get a different rate of change of temperature if you want travel one path or the other. And so that indicates that you're traveling with different velocities. So the set of equivalence classes of such differentiable paths through P is then the set of tangent vectors, each tangent vector intuitively standing for a particular velocity vector. Now, we already saw that the algebraic and the physicist definitions match. Now, let's see whether the geometric and the algebraic definitions of tangent spaces agree. In practice, later we will not use the superscript algebraic, geometric, or physicist. We'll basically generally mean the algebraic definition, because it's way more powerful to define vectors and later tensors and operations on them through algebraic properties such as being a derivation on an algebra than to deal with derivatives and explicit things that require taking equivalence classes of paths and changes of charts and things that are extraneous to it. You see, with the algebraic definition, you don't have to introduce paths. With the algebraic definition, you don't have to introduce coordinate systems and coordinate system charts. So the algebraic definition is much more self-contained. Okay, so let's see whether the geometric and the algebraic definitions match. Well, yes, they do. Each path gamma defines actually a linear map, which obeys the Leibniz rule. And therefore, every such path defines for us a tangent vector in the algebraic sense. So let's say the path is denoted by gamma. Then we will call the map that obeys the Leibniz rule, and therefore the corresponding algebraically defined tangent vector, by gamma bar. But how is gamma bar defined given the path gamma? So gamma bar has to be a map that acts on functions. It has to be a directional derivative in the algebraic sense. So it has to, as input, take a function or a function germ and maps it into the real numbers such as to obey the Leibniz rule. And for that, we use this definition. We say that gamma bar, given a path, gamma bar, path through P, of course, which has as its parameter value 0 when it passes through P, we say that gamma bar is the map that takes a function or function germ and maps it into that rate of temperature change that we talked about, where F, function germ, is our function is viewed as a temperature map. So for every path, you get one of those algebraic tangent vectors. Namely, you feed it a function, and then you concatenate it with the path. You get a rate of change of the function then at that point. Now we just have to show that this map, gamma bar, from the functions, function germs, into R obeys the product rule on the Leibniz rule. So we apply this now to the product of two functions, like the product of two temperature functions. Okay, so the application of gamma bar on the product of two functions is d by dt, and then here it's not just f, but it's a product of f and g. So it's a product of f and g after gamma. And in practice, it is this. It's d by dt, and then it's the one function evaluated where the path is multiplied with the other function where the path is. And then we differentiate that with respect to t at the point p, where the parameter value is 0. And you see how this goes. This is now just the ordinary derivative of ordinary scalar functions, ordinary functions from R into R, after all. T is an element of R, and f, the output, is an element of R. So we simply have ordinary function from R to R, ordinary function from R to R. The whole thing is a function from R to R. This is a d by dt of that. The ordinary Leibniz rule applies. And therefore, we get that this is d by dt of f times g, not differentiated, plus f not differentiated and g differentiated. So the Leibniz rule of ordinary functions on R provides us with the Leibniz rule for the abstract tangent vectors, according to the algebraic definition of the tangent space, that are induced by path. So we have that gamma bar of f times g plus f gamma bar of g is gamma bar of fg, which means that the Leibniz rule applies. And therefore, gamma bar is directly an element of the tangent space, the algebraic tangent space. So the three definitions are equivalent. Any questions so far? Okay, so finally, let's move on to the cotangent space. Remember that when you have an n-dimensional vector space V, then the set of linear maps from the vector space into the real numbers also forms an n-dimensional vector space. In infinite dimensions, it's, by the way, still possible, but the dimensions, it's not as simple as that. The dimensions don't have to match. And it can easily happen that the dual space is much larger than the original space. But here, we don't have to worry about it, because our tangent spaces are going to be finite dimension. So in n-dimensional vector spaces, the set of linear maps from that vector space into the real number also forms a linear vector space. Simply because if you have one linear map and you can add to it another linear map, and together they also still form a linear map obtained by just adding their outputs. It's a linear thing to do. Also, when you take a linear map and you multiply it with 27, it's still a linear map. And that's really all you have to check to know that it's a vector space. That it has the same dimension is a separate issue to prove, but it's one of those things you've done in linear algebra. So this is called the dual space, and we denote it by V star. We can do this construction for the tangent space. So the dual vector space to the tangent space at the point P is called the cotangent space, and we will denote it by TPM star. Tangent space at the point P of the manifold M, dual of it. Now, what might be those elements? What are the elements of the dual to the tangent space? We know some things about these elements. We know that they are linear maps on tangent vectors. So they take as input tangent vectors, and they map them into the real numbers. But we already know some cotangent vectors, not in this abstract way, but we had them before. Namely, it turns out that for every germ of a function, for every f in the algebra of function germs, we naturally already obtain an element of the cotangent space, of the dual space to the tangent vector space. So when we construct the space of cotangent vectors, we don't have to treat them just as abstract things that are linear maps somehow, and we just give them names and we have them. But no, they arise very naturally. And what we are saying here is that for any function germ at a point P, you already get canonically a cotangent vector. How? Well, first let's give it a name. If f is a function germ or a function that generates a function germ, then the cotangent vector that is induced by it, that comes for free along with that function germ, will be called df. And you know the notation df, of course, from other considerations earlier on in physics, and it might be called a differential and whatnot, but don't think of anything infinitesimal. Just drop that thought. It has nothing to do with infinitesimal. So you take an f, and then the cotangent vector that is induced by our function f, or function germ f, the cotangent vector will be called df, element of the cotangent vector to point p. And it will be called a differential of f, but don't think of infinitesimal. Okay? And how will it, how, what is it, the df? It's supposed to be an element of the dual to the tangent vector space. So it's supposed to take tangent vectors as input and give you a number as output in a linear fashion. That's all that's needed. A dual vector is a linear map on your vector space. It maps your vector space vectors into real numbers in a linear fashion. So the df is defined to be, for every function germ f, the df is defined to be the map that takes a tangent vector, maps it into a real number in the following way. Df takes a tangent vector as its input and calculates the directional derivative of f in the direction of psi. So you apply your tangent vector on your function, and that gives you a number, and the whole thing is linear. Because remember, tangent vectors are linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. So if you take here 5 times f, you get 5 times the answer. If you take 5 times psi, you get 5 times the answer. And that's important. If you take 5 times psi, you get 5 times the answer. If you take psi plus eta, 2 tangent vectors, you get the sum of the outputs. And so this is a linear map. So for every function that generates a function germ, for every function you can define and write down immediately a cotangent vector. And the cotangent vector is this linear map on tangent vectors. It takes the tangent vector, maps it into this real number, tangent vector applied to the function, which is the directional derivative in the direction of psi of f. So we can view the procedure of going from a function germ. This is just this is a tangential remark. We are going from f to df, from function germs to cotangent vectors. And this is a kind of a map. You take as input a function, and as output, you get a tangent vector. And the map may be called d, right? So it feeds on functions and outputs cotangent vectors. And that map will later be extended into becoming a so-called co-boundary operator. But for now, we have D mapping functions into cotangent vectors, or function germs, really, into cotangent vectors. How does this look like explicitly in a chart? Concretely, in a coordinate system, that is, in a chart, the abstract tangent vector to a point P, and the abstract function germ around at the point P correspond to some explicit tangent vector in a coordinate system about the point Q, which is the coordinate of the point P, the image of the point P in Rn, and the abstract function germ corresponds to a concrete function germ over Rn. So let's work with the images, where everything can be made very explicit. So what then is DG? DG is mapping a tangent vector into a real number, and it does it in this way. You feed in the tangent vector, namely the image eta of xi in a chart, and then you map that into the number obtained by applying that tangent vector to a function, which is to say you calculate the directional derivative of the function in the direction of eta. And the advantage of doing this in a chart is that we know that all tangent vectors in Rn take this particular form with some coefficients eta I. And we know that the abstract function f, once you write it in a chart, takes the form of a concrete function g over some coordinates x. So that's what we obtain. The cotangent vector is mapping tangent vectors into this number, which is obtained by taking this directional derivative of the function at the point q, which is the image of the point p. And remember that the chart is, and everything associated with the chart is designed in such a way that it really doesn't matter whether we do things in a chart or on the manifold, right? Evaluate a tangent vector on a function. It doesn't matter in which chart you apply the tangent vector on a function. It doesn't matter whether you do it in any chart or on the manifold itself, always the same output. That's how we define the notion of pullback. So it's perfectly legal that it's not a restriction of generality that we here evaluate the action of the cotangent vector onto on a tangent vector in a chart, because it's going to give us exactly the same thing as what is abstractly going on with applying the original xi on the original f. It's a faithful image of that. Now, since all tangent vectors to a point q take this form, it means that a basis of the tangent vector is given by the partial derivatives. Remember, we discussed that earlier. The partial derivatives are independent, are linearly independent. You can't get the directional derivative in the third direction by linearly combining the partial derivatives in the first and the second direction, for example. So these guys form a basis. They're linearly independent of each other, these ones. We don't have a notion of norm or metric on these vectors just yet, but we can say that they're linearly independent. That much we can say. And so they form a basis. And then we can ask, what is the dual basis? So with every coordinate system, we get automatically a canonical basis in the tangent space, the d by dxi. Is there a canonical dual basis then that arises with that first basis of the tangent space? And there is. Consider the coordinate functions, xk. So what is that? What is a coordinate function? Well, you have a coordinate system. And you can view the coordinate function x1 as a function that lives on the manifold, abstract manifold. And x1 associates to every point on the manifold a number, namely the value of x1 at that point. You can view the coordinate system, the coordinate system functions, the xk, each individually as a function on the manifold. These are the functions that we called phi I before, for example. Right? So you map, the phi I was actually from one coordinate system to another coordinate system. So the coordinate functions just map points on the manifold onto their coordinates, and in particular, if you pick one coordinate, it's a function on the manifold. Consider these coordinate functions. These coordinate functions are just functions on the manifold, and therefore they induce for us, just like any f did, they will induce for us cotangent vectors. So let's see which are the cotangent vectors for that are induced by the coordinate functions. So we apply our D. Remember, D is mapping functions into cotangent vectors. So now we apply that and we check what is the cotangent vector that we obtain when we take the D of xk. We know it's a cotangent vector, but what are its properties? Well, let's see. It's mapping tangent vectors into numbers in the following way. The dxk is mapping a tangent vector, and let's take, just to be completely explicit, let's take this tangent vector. It's a tangent vector in a particular direction. It's a tangent vector if you remember, the partial derivatives form a basis in the tangent space. And we pick just one basis vector now. The dxk, by definition, by the way we define what the d does, this is the cotangent vector that maps this onto the evaluation of that tangent vector on the function. So it's this derivative acting on the function. It's the directional derivative of our function. And that is just this, evaluated at the point in question, and that is, of course, just a conical delta, which tells us that if we take these functions and look at their differentials, dxk, we obtain cotangent vectors, which are the dual basis to the basis in the tangent space, d by dxi. So now we have, once we choose a coordinate system, once we choose a chart, we can immediately write down a basis in a tangent space, namely the d by dxi. These are directional derivatives. These are, according to the algebraic definition, tangent vectors because the partial derivatives are linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. So we have a basis in a tangent space. But we also quickly get a basis in the cotangent space. In fact, a dual basis in the cotangent space. Namely, by looking at the differential, by taking the differentials of the coordinate functions. Now, this is super convenient. In a way, it's too convenient. Because when you first study general relativity, this is taken for granted. Implicitly, this is taken for granted. It's so convenient that in most early studies of general relativity, most first courses in general relativity, these are the bases you get to choose always. So whenever there's a tangent space, you choose the basis of the d by dxi as the basis. Whenever there's a cotangent space, you may want to choose the dxk as a basis. Nothing wrong with that. But it sort of colors your view of general relativity because you get used to seeing the equations of general relativity always relative to these choices of bases. And then if you change to another coordinate system, you adapt to that coordinate system's new basis of the same kind, d by dxi, and for the tangent vector, tangent space basis, and then the dx's for the basis in the cotangent space. And so you get used to these things and you think, oh, it just has to be like that, the formulas have to look like that. But they don't. It's a very important observation that we can make at this point, that these are just choices of bases. Convenient choices, perhaps, but just choices. You could choose other bases. So for example, when you do general relativity, and I assume that almost all of you have done general relativity before. You know that you can write down the metric tensor as some g mu nu of x, and it will have some, in general, in some coordinate system, will have some general form. And then if somebody gives you a metric tensor, you might look at that and say, oh, that one looks really complicated. Probably it's describing a complicated space-time. Another metric tensor might look more simple, and you might think, oh, probably a simpler space-time. But usually when somebody gives you a metric tensor, writes down g mu of x, they assume this without spelling it out. Because actually, if you use the freedom to choose your basis and your tangent and cotangent spaces cleverly, not necessarily the ones that come with your coordinate system, but really you can choose any basis you want. And if you choose your basis cleverly, you can arrange that your metric tensor, g mu nu, is always looking exactly the same as in special relativity. It's just minus 1, 1, 1, 1, everywhere on the manifold at the same time. Now all the information about the curvature is in the changes of basis. And that can be very convenient and very powerful. There is no reason why we should write general relativity in a way that is tied to a change of coordinates. It might be useful to write general relativity in a way where we make use of the freedom that we have in the choice of basis to accommodate the physics of it rather than the math of it. All right, enough of a rant. Okay. So we have a dual basis as well. These guys form a dual basis in the space of, in the cotangent space. So these are bases in the cotangent space. Okay. So every element of the cotangent space must be a linear combination of these guys. So if omega is an element of the cotangent space, so a linear map from the tangent space into the real numbers, then it must be some linear combination of these guys. You see, we have n of them. And we know from linear algebra that the cotangent space is also n-dimensional. We already have n linearly independent basis vectors, so that's it. Therefore, that must be true. Every element of the cotangent space must be some linear combination of the dxi. And then the action of such a general element of the cotangent space is, well, it feeds on tangent vectors and maps it linearly into real numbers. It does it this way. Take your cotangent vector, always takes this form. You take your cotangent vector, and then you feed it a tangent vector to eat it, and then output a number. And how does it do it? Well, it outputs a number in the following way. You take your cotangent vector, that's the form it always takes, and then you feed it a tangent vector. All tangent vectors take this form. And the whole thing is linear, so you can pull the etas and the omegas always out. So we put here the omega, here the eta. And we have that the dxi act on the d by dxj. The cotangent vectors are fed these tangent vectors. But how are they being fed those tangent vectors? Remember how the differential works. The differential of a function is a cotangent vector, which acts on tangent vectors by feeding the function to the tangent vector. So dxi acts on d by dxi by feeding the tangent vector this function. So this tangent vector is eating now that function. That just gives us the Kronecker delta. And we just get this, that these two sums become one sum because we have a Kronecker delta. And then we just get that this comes out. So when we apply a cotangent vector on a tangent vector, then the output is a number, which is obtained by multiplying these coefficients and summing them up. Let's call this equation equation 1. Now, let's keep this business here in mind. In particular now, what if g is an arbitrary function, not a coordinate function? What linear combination of the dxi is the g, is the dg? So the differential to g has to be expandable in our basis of cotangent vectors. How? So what exactly is the differential of g when expanded in the basis of the cotangent vector that we have here? We know that dg has to be some linear combination of the dxk, because these guys are tangent, a basis of our cotangent vector space. What we don't know is what these coefficients are. Let's calculate them. Right, so let's remember what the differential of a function is. The differential of a function is a cotangent vector, so it wants to eat a tangent vector to spit out a number. And it does it in this way by the definition of the differential, namely, the differential of g acting on the tangent vector is obtained by letting the tangent vector eat the function. Calculate the direction derivative of g in the direction of eta. Explicitly, this is this. This is the tangent vector eta is this. And we let it eat the function g. All of that evaluated, of course, at the point in question. And what we see is that the differential of g acting on eta is this. Numbers times numbers summed over all I. Has to be true for all eta. Let's compare. See? Abstract cotangent vector acting on a tangent vector gives us this simple linear combination. It's the product of the coefficients summed up. And what that means is that these coefficients, the omega I, are the coefficients of omega. We are looking for the coefficients of dg. We want to know what these coefficients are of dg in the basis of the tangent, cotangent space. And what we can now read off is that the coefficients of dg in the basis of the cotangent vectors have to be these, right? Because this has to be sum over eta I multiplied with the coefficients of dg summed over I. So these guys have to be the coefficients of dgs. These have to be those omega k's. So what we find is that the coefficients of dg, we call them omega I, are these partial derivatives of g. Therefore, we have that the differential of an arbitrary function is given by this linear combination of the basis vectors in the cotangent space. And the coefficients here of this linear combination are the partial derivatives of our function g in the directions of in the coordinate directions. I'm sure you've seen things like that before. Maybe this is just a different setting of it. Now assume that we have a cotangent vector and we have two charts. Two charts, let's call them alpha and beta, just as before. Remember this picture where we had the abstract manifold in the middle and then the chart left, the chart right. Let's see how these things change coordinates. So let's say this is the abstract cotangent vector, and then it corresponds to a concrete cotangent vector with respect to a chart in a concrete cotangent space over Rn with respect to one chart, and another cotangent vector with respect to another chart, another cotangent space over Rn. And that means that our abstract cotangent vector has coefficients with respect to one coordinate system and coefficients with respect to another coordinate system. Again, at this point, let me remind you that these are coefficients with respect to the coordinate systems, assuming that we want to use this basis and that basis in the cotangent spaces. We don't have to. We can keep our coordinate system. We can keep the two coordinate systems that we work with. And yet, we are free to choose different bases in the cotangent spaces, different bases in the tangent spaces. We usually don't, but I just want to remind you that we can choose other bases if we want to. For the next few lectures, we will still stick with these bases. But soon enough, we will free ourselves from that choice and work with general bases. Okay, so the same abstract cotangent vector in one coordinate system with its corresponding induced bases in tangent cotangent spaces will have this representation or that representation with respect to another coordinate system. And then I leave it to you as an exercise to show that the coordinates transform in this particular way. You go from omega I to mu I using these transformations. Very similar to how we did it for the tangent vectors. And of course, the traditional physics definition would be that a cotangent vector is an n-tuple, which transforms in this particular way. But here it just pops out as a consequence. Some notation and terminology. Elements of the tangent space are called contravariant vectors. Elements of the cotangent space are also called covariant vectors. And we will sometimes write tangent vectors in this way, where you notice there's a point P here. P is on the abstract manifold. And on the abstract manifold, we don't have that. And similarly, we may write that a cotangent vector is written in this way, without referring to a chart. That is just convenient. We are sort of saying, well, we write things as if we were doing this on the abstract manifold itself, but really we are working in a chart. I just don't bother to write down charts. Right? So often in calculations, you will see these things, and you just have to keep in mind that that becomes true if you use a chart. So we are now ready to define tensors. Any questions so far? Okay. So a tensor T of rank R and S is an element of the tensor space with indices S and R at the point P. We are still working at each point of the manifold individually, and the tensor space is a tensor product, or the tensor spaces are tensor products of the tangent and cotangent spaces. Namely, if we have R tensor factors of tangent spaces, then we put the number R up here, and however many tensor factors of cotangent spaces we want to consider, let's say the number S, then we put an S here. Which means in particular that if we just take one factor of the tangent spaces and none of the cotangent spaces, then we just have a 1 up here and a 0 down there, we just have the tangent space. If on the other hand we take one factor of here and none of that, then we have a 0, 1, and then that's the cotangent space. These guys come with bases once we choose a chart. We don't have to use those bases, but again, it's convenient to do many times. But just like in quantum mechanics, you shouldn't be too tied to one particular representation, like the position representation or momentum representation or Fock representation or any other of infinitely many representations. The physics goes on behind the scenes on an abstract level. Choice of representation, position, momentum, Fock, or whatever doesn't affect the physics, and so similarly here, the choice of bases in your tangent and cotangent spaces doesn't affect the physics. But it's one choice that's equivalent to any others, mathematically speaking. So if we choose the bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces that come with the coordinate systems, these basis vectors, then we get the basis of the tensor space simply by tensoring those basis vectors, of course, and then an arbitrary tensor in that tensor space, in that space of RS tensors, is given by a linear combination of these basis vectors, where these linear combination coefficients are all real numbers. And then when we change chart, when we change coordinate systems, these basis vectors, those basis vectors, these choices of basis vectors mean that we change, that we have a change in the coefficient. Let me repeat that because it's an important point. When we change coordinate system, these coefficients change, but the reason is not that we change coordinate system. The reason is that we change bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces. Right? If we change coordinate system, remember the first coordinate system came with its canonical bases, those guys. And its canonical bases in the cotangent space, those guys. If we change it to another coordinate system, this other coordinate system has different directions there, right? So it has different basis vectors in the tangent space. It has different basis vectors in the cotangent space. And if we are lazy, we might just go along with a new choice of bases that comes with a new choice of coordinates. And then, as always, when you have a vector space and you write a vector as a linear combination of its basis vectors, and then you decide to use another basis, well, don't be surprised if the vector, the same vector, now has different coefficients with respect to the new basis. That's what we do now. We change bases as we go from one coordinate system to the other. But what you could do, just for fun, is that as you change coordinate system, you could choose to keep your old basis vectors in the tangent spaces. You could choose to keep your old basis vectors in the cotangent spaces. What would happen to those coefficients? Nothing. It would exactly stay the same. Because it's the same tangent spaces, it's the same vectors, and if you're not changing bases, nothing changes. Right? So the reason why the coefficients change is that we change bases out of convenience. If we always want to choose the bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces that come with the coordinate systems, that are suggested by the coordinate system, namely these guys and those guys, well, then we have to, as we change coordinate system and change, because of convenience, the bases with, along with it, we have to change the coefficients there too. But if we don't change bases in the tangent and cotangent spaces, the coefficients never change. Okay. Which is also why, fundamentally, you know, it doesn't feel right to define tangent vectors, cotangent vectors, and tensors, and so on, under their transformation rules, because it's so artificial. You have to choose charts, you have to choose the bases that are suggested by those charts, and then check how the coefficients change of vectors under your changes of bases. And that is supposed to define your tangent and cotangent vectors. It's not intrinsic. Okay. Right, so under change of chart, if we change the bases along with them, then that's the change of coefficients. As I already mentioned, the tangent space is a special case of the tensor space with indices 1, 0 cotangent space. Cotangent vectors are tensors of rank 0, 1, and tensors contravariant vectors, tangent vectors, are tensors of rank 1, 0. Finally, we are ready to go from local to global. Let's look at the definition. We want to combine all the tangent spaces together. And the way we can do that is, the way it's done is this. We take the union for all points of the pair, point of the manifold, and tangent space at that point. So these are tuples, right? It's two things in a set here. It's a point and a tangent vector space. So this is an entire vector space. That's just a point of the manifold. And the union of all those tuples will be called a tangent bundle. And it itself has the structure of a differentiable manifold. We won't dwell on that, but let me just mention it's 2n-dimensional, as you can convince yourself how many parameters do you need to describe such a thing. N for P, N for the tangent vectors. So Tm, the tangent bundle, is also called the total space of this particular tangent bundle. And M, the manifold, the first factor part of it, M, the manifold on which we built this tangent bundle, is also called the base space. Now, remember that all the tangent vectors, each individual tangent vector space, is n-dimensional. It's an n-dimensional real vector space. And therefore, it is isomorphic to Rn. All n-dimensional real vector spaces are isomorphic to each other. So in particular, all those n-dimensional tangent spaces are isomorphic to each other. And we therefore call Rn the standard fiber. Fiber meaning this part of it. You see, there are more than just tangent bundles, as we will see later on. This is the bundle we get when we take all of the tangent spaces, but in which case we have Rn here, but we can also have other bundles. In this case, it's this is called the standard fiber. The fiber is a vector space, an n-dimensional vector space attached to each point. One obtains other fiber bundles by choosing other standard fibers. For example, we can define the cotangent bundle using a union of points and cotangent spaces as above. We can define the RS tensor bundle in this way. We can define bundles for isospinners as they occur in the standard model, for example, for the strong interaction, vector bundles of various kinds and applications. And for gauge theories, we can define bundles in which we don't have attached vector spaces, but for example, groups, Lie groups. And then we can have, for example, principal bundles, which would be mapping. We'll get to that. So the map, which takes your bundle, in our case, the tangent bundle, and projects it down to just the manifold. So remember what the tangent bundle is. It is this union of all the tuples of points and tangent spaces. And now if you delete all the tangent spaces, you're just left with the points. So the map pi, which projects this thing down to the base manifold, so it just takes these tuples and removes that and just gives you the points, that map is called the bundle projection. And the section sigma of such a tangent bundle is a map sigma from the manifold into the tangent bundle, which is a right inverse of pi. So basically, it does sort of the opposite. It gives you, for every point p, an element in here. So a section will give you an element in the tangent bundle where you can then take the base projection and you get back just the point. So you can write it this way, that sigma, a section, has to be a right inverse of the projection. So you first map into the tangent bundle and then you map it down again into the base manifold and you get back the point that you started with. Now, remember what the graph of a function is? The graph of a function f from A to B is the set of tuples where you write down the input left and the output of the function right. It's literally what you would plot on paper, and you plot the graph of a function. X-axis, y-axis, right? And so for every pair of points x and y, such that y is f of x. You draw a point on the paper. So that's literally the graph of a function. It's also the technical term for the graph of a function, where a and b don't have to be R. They could be any arbitrary set. So the graph of an arbitrary map is given by the set of tuples where on the left you have the input, on the right you have the output. And so the graph of a what physicists would call a field, a function that lives on the manifold, is a section of its fiber bundle, right? So you take your field, phi of x, for example, and you look at its graph. So you look at all the x and the values phi of x. And the union of all those guys then is, on one hand, the graph of your function, but on the other hand, it's also a section of your fiber bundle, of your tangent bundle, because if you now take this and you apply the bundle projection on it, so you remove that part, you just get back to the manifold. A tangent vector field is then a map which will map points of the manifold into tangent vectors at that, into a tangent vector at that point of the manifold. And in a chart, concretely, it will be that for every point in the manifold, you get a tangent vector. Remember, tangent vectors are directional derivatives according to the algebraic definition. So this way we get a tangent vector field. Remember, this looks very much like what we did so far all along, but this is now a field in the sense that it's for all x at the same time. You're no longer picking out one particular point p. No, a field gives you for every point of the manifold a tangent vector. And a cotangent vector field is a map that gives you as input you have a point of the manifold, and as output it is a cotangent vector to that point. And in a chart it looks like this. A cotangent vector field can always be written like this. For every point x, you have coefficients. And these coefficients multiply the basis vectors, multiply basis vectors in the local cotangent spaces. Right? So at every point on the manifold, these guys form a basis in the cotangent space. And every cotangent vector is some linear combination of these basis vectors, and a general cotangent vector field will have some, in general, x-dependent coefficients with respect to this basis here. Similarly, tensor fields give you, for every point of the manifold, a tensor in the local tensor space of rank Rs. And in a chart, it means you choose, let's say, this convenient basis here, then you have these coefficient functions. So at every point, just remember that this is not one tangent vector. This is not one coordinate. This is not one cotangent vector. But instead, at every point in the manifold, this expression stands for a basis vector in a cotangent space. But of course, this stands for a tangent vector at that tangent space. But of course, the x1 derivative at one point doesn't live in the tangent space to another point, right? So at every point in the manifold, you have a separate tangent space. You have a separate basis. And this is just a super compact way of writing down a choice of basis for all of those tangent spaces, for all of those cotangent spaces. But we need to keep that in mind, because later on, when we consciously choose what basis to use for the tangent space here, and the tangent space there, and elsewhere, and so on, the cotangent spaces, we choose our basis. We generally choose our basis in a position-dependent way, which means that we won't just write down such a thing here. We will have functions that describe which basis we choose where. And if, for example, we want to choose a particular basis, how do we describe which basis we really want to work with? Well, we can always describe it relative to this basis, for example. This basis comes with a coordinate system, but we may not want to work with it. So we may want to designate another basis as as useful. Well, we can express any new basis as a linear combination of the old basis. But that linear combination can be space-time dependent. And so expect more space-time dependent functions in this business. You may wonder, oh, that just makes it more complicated. It doesn't really, because you can choose things in such a way, your basis, for example, such that, yes, you get more space-time dependence in here in your choice of basis, but these guys will be much simpler. For example, the metric tensor could be just the metric tensor of special relativity all over the space-time. That's pretty simple. That's a very useful simplification, which, for example, is very useful if you want to write down the Dirac equation on curved space-time. Because if you remember, the Dirac equation required a definition of gamma matrices. The anti-commutator of the gamma matrices is having on the right-hand side the Minkowski space metric. If you allowed the metric to be wildly varying, just like the Schwarzschild metric in any textbook, well, then you would need different gamma matrices at every point, because you have a different matrix for the metric at every point. That would be super tedious. So one use of the freedom of choice of basis is to make sure that the metric is always eta mu, and then you can do, for example, the Dirac equation much easier. All right, so why would we bother with fiber bundles? Why don't we just talk about vector fields, cotangent vector fields, and tensor fields? Well, actually, it's a bit of overkill. In general relativity, we don't necessarily need that, because space-time, we don't have evidence that space-time has holes and handles that it has the topology of a pretzel or something. But we could describe such a thing with fiber bundles. Fiber bundles are useful to capture situations where the manifold in question is globally non-trivial, even though locally things might be relatively smooth. We just have ordinary things as we might imagine. So fiber bundles are required to be locally trivial always, but not globally. So what this means is this. The requirement that fiber bundles are locally trivial means that the manifold can be covered with neighborhoods so that the bundle over these neighborhoods, you see, pi inverse is the pre-image of the bundle projection. So it's the part of the bundle over that. It's such that the pre-image of the patch of these patches of the manifolds are just trivially the patch of the manifold tensored with Rn, or Kronecker product with Rn. So what this means is, remember that the tangent spaces are all isomorphic to Rn. And so one might think that the entire fiber bundle, the entire tangent bundle, is simply the manifold cross Rn. But that's not necessarily so. We want this to be locally true. Locally, we simply have the points of the manifold and the points of Rn. That should always be true for patches of the manifold. But globally, it doesn't have to be true. You could have a manifold of this kind of shape with a hole in the middle. And then you could have that there's a patch U1, which is like this, and a patch U2, which is like this, and they have some overlap. And then on this patch, we have that the fiber bundle, the tangent bundle, is isomorphic to just the patch times Rn. On this patch as well, because the whole thing is required to be locally trivial, we have that it's simply the patch times Rn. But it could be that these isomorphisms are such that they don't fit together here, that there's a relative map between them in here. And that's because there's a hole in there. You can have that in a smooth way. It's like a Möbius band, if you like. So for a suitable vector bundle, B, we can have that that the part of the tangent bundle over here and the part of the tangent bundle over there are both isomorphic to U1 and Rn and U2 cross Rn. But in the overlap regions, the isomorphisms may differ. You see, this symbol means isomorphic, but they may differ. And so the whole thing, the entire vector bundle over the entire thing here may not be isomorphic to the entire manifold cross Rn. Now, we don't have evidence that space-time has holes. Well, singularities, but not donut-like, not pretzel-like. So where does it come up? Well, string theorists are very interested in that because strings, when they evolve through time, can combine and interact and so on. And you get all sorts of non-trivial pretzel-like structures out of this. So topology in that sense, not topology in the sense of the beginning of the course, but topology in this sense, holes and handles are very important for string theory. Topology also comes up for gauge theories, for example, QCD. But for general relativity, not so much. We don't have any evidence for it to play a role. Maybe at the Planck scale, there could be holes and handles appearing as quantum fluctuations, but no positive evidence for that yet. Okay, so almost done. For the algebra of functions, of C-infinity functions, infinitely many times continuously differentiable functions on the manifold, we will now write f of m. This is no longer germs, this is actual functions. We drop the index over here. And one can show that contravariant vector fields are derivations of the algebra of scalar functions on the manifold. We did it only for individual points earlier. We did it for points because it was important that our tangent spaces are finite dimensional, that the dual is of the same dimension, and so on. If we did everything for the entire manifold at all, all together, well, you see, the tangent bundle, you know, you can't write down a finite basis for that. If you look at the cotangent spaces or tangent vector fields, you know, the space of tangent vector fields is not n-dimensional. It's infinite dimensional, just like any function space. So it was important that we did things first for points, but now we upgrade the whole thing to look at the entire manifold altogether. So now if psi is a contravariant vector field, so for every point of the manifold, we get a tangent vector. Remember, tangent vectors are contravariant, cotangent vectors are covariant. So if psi is a contravariant vector field, then what it does is that it feeds on functions and outputs functions again. Remember that tangent vectors at a point feed on a function germ and output a number, the directional derivative, the value of the directional derivative. But a tangent vector field is feeding on an entire function and it outputs the value of the directional derivative at each point and therefore another function. So tangent vectors now map functions into functions, which also means you can apply many tangent vectors in a row. You can take a tangent vector, apply it to a function, get a new function, apply another tangent vector on that, and so on and so on. You can look at commutators of tangent vectors, for example. First apply this one, and that one, and the other way around, and we'll do that. So psi is a contravariant vector field. If psi is a contravariant vector field, it will map functions to the functions in a linear way, obeying the Leibniz rule, namely cotangent vector applied to the product of two functions gives you cotangent vectors applied to a function times g plus the other way around. And that's true for all functions. The next topic we will do is differential forms. This is, I think, the last slide. So we have already covered differential forms, two cases. We already introduced two kinds of differential forms just without you telling that they are. Namely, functions. Functions on the manifold. Scalar functions on the manifold are also called zero forms. And another way to write f of m, the space of functions on the manifold, is lambda zero. Zero for zero forms. We also have the set of covariant vector fields. The set of covariant vector fields is also called lambda one. And later on, we will define, this is anticipating it, we will also define n forms or r forms for r equal 2 or 3 and so on, and these will be the set of totally antisymmetric tensor fields of rank 0r. Why they are of particular interest is important. Let me just anticipate it. Because of their transformation properties, they will allow us to define integration. Among all tensors, the totally antisymmetric covariant ones are special because they are exactly the things that are needed to define integration in differential geometry. That's as far as we got today. I'm sorry we went a few minutes late. Okay?